This CLE is based on the appellate decisions addressing issues related to negligence, summarized on the website New York Appellate Digest. Those summaries have been collected in a negligence update pamphlet, and it is that pamphlet which constitutes the written materials for the CLE, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is on page 4, Medical Care of Western New York. It has to do with the adequacy of the pleading for negligent hiring and supervision and prima facie tort. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff did not state valid causes of action for negligent hiring and supervision and prima facie tort. The court wrote, although an employer may be liable for a claim of negligent hiring or supervision, if an employee commits an independent act of negligence outside the scope of employment, and the employer was aware of or reasonably should have foreseen the employee's propensity to commit such an act, the amended complaint failed to allege that the acts of defendant's employees were committed independent of defendant's instruction or outside the scope of employment. And turning to prima facie tort, the court wrote, there can be no recovery for prima facie tort unless a disinterested malevolence to injure a plaintiff constitutes the sole motivation for the defendant's otherwise lawful act. Here, the amended complaint alleged the defendant acted in bad faith and intentionally caused harm to plaintiff by requesting verifications and examinations under oath. Those conclusory allegations failed to state that defendant had a malicious motive unmixed with any other and exclusively directed to the injury and damage of plaintiff. Furthermore, it is a critical element of a prima facie tort cause of action that plaintiff suffered specific and measurable loss. Next is the Suzanne P. case on pages 5 and 6. It has to do with tort liability under Espinal that stems from a contract with a third party, and it also deals with the assumption of risk. The Fourth Department held that the Soil Conservation and Watershed Board's motion for summary judgment in this wrongful death case was properly denied. The board operated and maintained a dam pursuant to a contract with a federal agency, the Natural Resources Conservation Service. The dam was submerged, and plaintiff's decedent sustained drowning injuries which led to his death after he waded into the water and went over the dam. The court noted that the assumption of risk doctrine applies only to sporting events and did not apply to these facts. With regard to the Espinal theory of liability stemming from a contract, the court said, a contractual obligation standing alone will generally not give rise to tort liability in favor of a third party, citing Espinal at 98 New York 2nd, page 138. Although, as relevant here, the third exception to that rule applies where the contracting party has entirely displaced the other party's duty to maintain the premises safely. We conclude that the contract between the board and the Natural Resources Conservation Service was not so comprehensive and exclusive that it entirely displaced the Natural Resource Conservation Service's duty to maintain the premises safely, such that the board owed a duty to the decedent. And with respect to the assumption of risk, the court wrote, the Court of Appeals has made clear that, as a general rule, application of assumption of the risk should be limited to cases appropriate for absolution of duty, such as personal injury claims arising from sporting events, sponsored athletic and recreative activities, or athletic and recreational pursuits that take place at designated venues. Here, decedent was not engaging in a sporting event or recreative activity that was sponsored or otherwise supported by the board, nor was he wading and swimming at a designated venue. Next is the Calderon case on pages 6 and 7. It's another Espinal case, And it also addresses the foreseeability of a rescue attempt. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there were questions of fact whether the property owner, whose name was Cruzate or Cruzate, was negligent, and whether the cesspool contractor, that was Port Jefferson, launched an instrument of harm. Two young men were planning to build a campfire in the backyard of a rental property owned by Cruzate. The men did not realize the pieces of concrete they decided to move were cesspool covers. One of the men, Fuentes, fell in. The other, Castro, jumped in to rescue him. Both were asphyxiated by chemicals that had been added when the cesspool was serviced. The court wrote, the plaintiff raised a triable issue of fact as to whether the cesspool cover was in a defective condition because Port Jefferson had improperly replaced it after servicing the cesspool, enabling Suarez to get his fingers underneath the cover and lift it. The plaintiff submitted the affidavit of his expert, who opined that on the date of the accident, the cover was not secure to the ground. According to the expert, there was soil between the cover and the cesspool, so the cover did not rest firmly on the cesspool, which was a substantial factor in the deaths of Castro and Fuentes. Moreover, Cruzate, that's the property owner, testified that he hired Port Jefferson to service the cesspool, that he supervised the work, observed Port Jefferson lift the cesspool cover, and was present when the work was completed. Therefore, there are tribal issues of fact as to whether Cruzate had actual or constructive notice of the allegedly defective condition of the cesspool cover. The plaintiff raised a tribal issue of fact as to whether Port Jefferson launched a force of harm and created a dangerous condition by improperly replacing the cement cover after servicing the cesspool. And it cites Espinal, 98 New York 2nd, 136. With regard to the rescue, the foreseeability of the attempt to rescue Fuentes, the court said, the fact that Castro decided to jump into the cesspool in an attempt to save his friend does not necessarily act as a bar to recovery. In 1921, the Court of Appeals, in an opinion by Judge Benjamin Cardozo, established that with regard to the principle of foreseeability, danger invites rescue. The wrong that imperils life is a wrong to the imperiled victim. It is also a wrong to his rescuer. This principle applies where the actions of the injured person were reasonable in view of the emergency situation, that is, where the rescuer acted as a reasonably prudent person would act in the same situation, even if it later appears that the rescuer did not make the safest choice or exercise the best judgment. Next is the Bavi Soto case on pages 7 and 8. It has to do with the duty to control a guest. In this case, the court found that there was no duty to control the guest. The Fourth Department, over a dissent, held the sole proximate cause of plaintiff's burn injuries was a guest's, that's his name was Gray, pouring kerosene onto an active fire in a fire pit at defendant's home. All parties were adults. The mere presence of kerosene at the home did not constitute a dangerous condition. The dissenter argued defendant parent did not demonstrate his daughter did not breach a duty to control the conduct of Gray, who poured the kerosene on the fire. But the majority rejected that argument. The court wrote, although plaintiff correctly contends that defendants owed him a duty of care as a guest on their property, defendant's submissions establish that they did not breach their duty to act as reasonable persons in maintaining the property in a reasonably safe condition in view of all the circumstances, including the likelihood of injury to others, the seriousness of the injury, and the burden of avoiding the risk. All attendees of the gathering at defendant's property on the night of the incident were adults, and it was not unreasonable for defendants to allow the small group of adults to use the premises for an unsupervised gathering around a fire pit. Next is the Glen Wayne Development Corporation case on page 8. It's a legal malpractice case, and it involves the ability to dismiss a complaint based solely on documentary evidence. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that defendant's attorney's motion to dismiss the complaint in this legal malpractice action should have been granted because the transcript of the settlement proceeding, utterly refuted the allegations in the complaint. Plaintiff had alleged it was coerced by the defendants into settling the action. The court said, the plaintiff's allegations that it was coerced into settling the underlying action were utterly refuted by the admissions of its principals during the settlement proceeding that they had discussed the terms of the settlement with their attorneys, understood the settlement terms, and had no questions about them, that they were entering into the settlement freely of their own volition and without undue influence or coercion, and that they were satisfied with their legal representation. Next is the Retzk case, R-E-Z-K, on page 9. It's a medical malpractice case. It has to do with a civil procedure issue. The court did not have authority to dismiss the action because the 90-day notice had not been served. It also deals with a sanctions issue related to discovery demands. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the court did not have authority to dismiss the medical malpractice action pursuant to CPLR 3216 for failure to prosecute in the absence of a 90-day notice. The court further noted that although dismissal for failure to comply with discovery demands was not warranted, the preclusion of further discovery was appropriate. The court said, with regard to CPLR 3216, the courts have no authority to dismiss an action for failure to prosecute, whether on the ground of general delay or for failure to serve and file a note of issue, unless there has first been served a 90-day notice. Here it's undisputed that neither the Supreme Court nor the defendant served the requisite 90-day notice upon plaintiff. Then the court went on, dismissal of the complaint pursuant to CPLR 3126 subdivision 3 was unwarranted as a sanction for the plaintiff's failure to limit his disclosure demands. The remedy of dismissal is only warranted where there has been a clear showing that the failure to comply with discovery demands was willful and contumacious. The sanction of dismissal is available for the willful and contumacious failure to disclose, which did not occur here. The plaintiff submitted to a deposition by the defendants. However, the lengthy pendency of this action, the dispute over plaintiff's overbroad demands for disclosure, and his refusal to tailor those demands in accordance with prior orders of the court compels the conclusion that further disclosure has been forfeited. Next is Lingua Li, page 10, another medical malpractice case, and it deals with another civil practice issue. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the motion to dismiss the medical malpractice action should not have been granted on the ground plaintiff had not moved, pursuant to CPLR 1202, to be appointed guardian ad litem for her comatose husband, Zeng, prior to commencing the action. The court wrote, the mere fact that this action was commenced before the plaintiff moved pursuant to CPLR 1202 to be appointed guardian ad litem or litem of her husband does not provide grounds for dismissal of the complaint pursuant to CPLR 3211A3. An incapacitated individual who has not been judicially declared incompetent may sue or be sued in the same manner as any other person. And CPLR 1202A expressly contemplates that a motion for the appointment of a guardian ad litem may be made at any stage in the action. Thus, there is no strict liability or strict legal requirement that the plaintiff should have been appointed guardian before the commencement of this action. While it would have been better for the action to have been commenced in Zeng's name, rather than by the plaintiff as proposed guardian ad litem of Zeng, the defect is not fatal particularly given the relatively short delay between the commencement of the action and the filing of plaintiff's guardianship motion. Next is Anonymous versus Gleason on page 11. It's another medical malpractice case which raises a civil practice issue. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant doctor's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice action should have been granted. Instead of answering the defendant's expert opinion that the doctor's actions were not the cause of the amniotic fluid embolism, which plaintiff alleged caused the death of plaintiff's decedent, the plaintiff, for the first time, alleged the cause of death was septic shock. Supreme Court erroneously denied defendant's motion for summary judgment and allowed the plaintiff to amend the complaint to allege the new theory. The court wrote, "The defendant met his prima facie burden as to proximate cause by submitting the affidavit of an expert in maternal fetal medicine who opined that any delay in the decedent undergoing an abortion procedure from the second trimester to the third trimester did not cause her to develop the amniotic fluid embolism, or AFE. In opposition, the plaintiff did not raise a triable issue of fact as to defendant's prima facie showing, but rather alleged for the first time a new theory of causation, claiming that the decedent died of septic shock. A plaintiff cannot, for the first time in opposition to a motion for summary judgment, raise a new or materially different theory of recovery against the party from those pleaded in the complaint and the bill of particulars. Once discovery has been completed and the case has been certified as ready for trial, a party will not be permitted to amend the bill of particulars except upon a showing of special and extraordinary circumstances. Here, the plaintiff failed to show special and extraordinary circumstances in seeking leave to amend the complaint and the bill of particulars in response to defendant's motion for summary judgment 3 years after the commencement of the action and almost 6 months after the filing of the note of issue. The plaintiff offered no reasonable excuse for relying solely on the medical examiner's report and for failing to explore his new theory of causation earlier in the proceedings. Moreover, permitting the amendment at this late stage of the proceedings would prejudice the defendant. Next is the Petion case. It's P-E-T-I-O-N. On page 12, it's another medical malpractice case that raises a civil practice issue. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's protracted delay in substituting father for the deceased infant in this medical malpractice action did not require dismissal of the complaint because the defendants were in possession of all the relevant medical records and therefore were not prejudiced by the delay. The court also noted that the motion to amend the complaint to assert wrongful death should have been granted under the relation back doctrine. The court wrote, CPLR 1021 requires a motion for substitution to be made within a reasonable time, and the determination of whether the timing is reasonable requires consideration of several factors, including the diligence of the party seeking substitution, the prejudice to other parties, and whether the party to be substituted has shown that the action or the defense has potential merit. Although the plaintiffs admit that the delay in seeking the substitution of the administrator was protracted, the plaintiffs showed that there was no prejudice to the defendants because the defendants were on notice of the claims against them as early as February 2009, when the plaintiffs filed a notice of claim against the defendant New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, and the defendants possessed all of the relevant medical records. The plaintiffs also demonstrated that they have a potentially meritorious cause of action through their expert's affidavit of merit, the pleadings, and the testimony of Marie Petion at the General Municipal Law 50H hearing. Next is the Cleveland case on pages 13 and 14, another medical malpractice case, which raised the issue whether the attending physicians or the emergency physicians' apparently erroneous conclusion that plaintiff's decedent had died constituted negligent infliction of emotional distress. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the negligent infliction of emotional distress cause of action should have been dismissed. Plaintiff's decedent suffered cardiac arrest and was pronounced dead by an emergency physician. His name is Perry. However, plaintiff's decedent was not in fact dead, and the emergency physician allegedly refused to examine plaintiff's decedent for nearly 3 hours. Plaintiff's decedent subsequently died after surgery at another hospital. The court wrote, "We agree with defendants that the court erred in denying their motion insofar as they sought summary judgment dismissing the cause of action of negligent infliction of emotional distress. A breach of duty of care resulting directly in emotional harm is compensable even though no physical injury occurred when the mental injury is a direct rather than consequential result of the breach and when the claim possesses some guarantee of genuineness. Here, defendants met their respective burdens of establishing as a matter of law that plaintiff and decedent's son did not suffer mental and emotional injuries causally related to Perry's erroneous pronouncement of decedent's death, and plaintiff failed to raise a triable issue of fact by demonstrating the requisite guarantee of genuineness with respect to her claims of mental or emotional injuries." Next is Williams on page 14. It's a case that deals with proximate cause. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the substantial plaintiff's verdict in this wrongful death case should have been set aside. It was alleged that the New York State Transit Authority was negligent in failing to make sure all passengers were off the subway train when the train reached the end of the line, requiring that it be repositioned in a relay tunnel. Plaintiff's decedent, who was intoxicated, remained on the train. At some point, he fell from the train in the relay tunnel and was killed. The court wrote, "Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, there's no valid line of reasoning and permissible inferences which could possibly lead rational people to conclude that the defendant's alleged negligence was the proximate cause of the decedent's injuries and death. Even assuming that the defendant's employees were negligent in failing to remove the decedent from the train before it was taken into the relay tunnel, the defendant's negligence merely furnished the condition or occasion for the occurrence of the decedent's fall from the train, rather than being one of its proximate causes." Next is the Corella case. It's on page 15. It's a slip and fall case, and it deals with a defendant's motion for summary judgment and what the defendant must prove to be awarded summary judgment in a slip and fall case. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted in the slip and fall case. Plaintiff alleged a discarded Metro card was the cause of her slip and fall on a train station stairwell. The defendant did not demonstrate when the stairwell was last inspected or cleaned. The court wrote, "Although the cleaner on duty in the station testified he was given a cleaner's manual and a written cleaning schedule, evidencing that defendant had a rational means for dealing with the problem of strewn Metro cards on the stairwell of train stations, the cleaner conceded that he could not recall whether he had deviated from his usual work schedule on the date of plaintiff's accident, and he did not have an independent recollection of when the staircase was last cleaned or inspected prior to the accident. Because defendant did not establish its prima facie entitlement to summary judgment, the burden never shifted to plaintiff to establish how long the condition existed." At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for this August 2019 negligence CLE. The verification code to be put on your attorney affirmation is INSTRUMENT. Again, the verification code for this August 2019 negligence update CLE is INSTRUMENT. Next is the Pinto case on page 18. It's a slip and fall case, and it involves the Espinal exception. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether defendant contractor launched an instrument of harm in the slip and fall case. Plaintiff alleged she tripped on a piece of masonite that had been placed over concrete that had just been poured. There was a question of fact whether the property owner had constructive notice of the condition. The court wrote, the defendant's submissions failed to eliminate all triable issues of fact as to whether Howell, that's the contractor, launched a force or instrument of harm through the failure to exercise reasonable care when its employee laid the subject masonite over the area of the floor where the self-leveling concrete had been poured. The evidence proffered by the defendants failed to demonstrate prima facie that the defendants lacked constructive notice of a hazardous condition on the premises. During an examination before trial, defendant's operations director was asked about his inspection tour of the mall on the morning of plaintiff's fall. His repeated descriptions of what he normally would do and probably would have done are ambiguous as to whether he is describing a specific inspection or merely describing a general inspection or general inspection policies and practices. Next is the Mihalatos case on pages 18 and 19. It's a three-car rear-end collision case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined that the middle driver, Budziak, in this three-car rear-end collision case was entitled to summary judgment. The court said, in a chain collision accident, the operator of the middle vehicle may establish prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by demonstrating that the middle vehicle was properly stopped behind the lead vehicle when it was struck from behind by the rear vehicle and propelled into the lead vehicle. Next is the Liang Ying Ren case on page 20. Involving injury on a bus, a common carrier. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held there was a question of fact whether the bus driver reacted properly to an emergency. Plaintiff, a passenger, was injured when the bus suddenly braked to avoid a fire truck entering an intersection. There was a question of fact whether the driver slowed down upon hearing the siren. Court wrote, the evidence proffered in support of the defendant's motion demonstrated prima facie that the operator of the bus was presented with an emergency situation, that being a fire truck that was entering the intersection against the traffic light, and that the operator acted as a reasonable person would under the circumstances. However, in opposition, the plaintiff noted that the operator testified at her deposition that as she approached the intersection, she heard a fire truck siren. Although the operator claimed she slowed down prior to reaching the intersection, the plaintiff testified at her deposition that the operator was driving pretty fast prior to the accident and that there was no change in speed. And turning to the last case, McCulloch, on pages 20 and 21, another traffic accident case. The Fourth Department noted that the term serious injury, not injury, should be used on a verdict sheet in a case involving insurance law section 5102. The court said, we note that the first question on the verdict sheet, was the accident a substantial factor in causing an injury to plaintiff, invites the very problem we addressed in another case, Brown v. Nigg, 163 AD 3rd, 1464, 4th Department, 2018. Where we noted that an interrogatory asking whether the plaintiff sustained an injury fails to address the appropriate legal issue, which is whether the plaintiff sustained a serious injury within the meaning of insurance law 5102 subdivision D. The first question on the verdict sheet was unnecessary here, inasmuch as the second and third questions asked the jury to determine whether plaintiff sustained a serious injury under the relevant categories that was causally related to the accident. So that includes the CLE, which is based on the appellate decisions addressing issues related to negligence,